In the end, you are weary of this ancient world. This morning, the bridges are bleating. Eiffel Tower, oh, heard. Weary of living in Roman antiquity and Greek. You read the handbills, the catalogues, the singing posters. So much for poetry this morning. And the prose is in the newspapers. Special editions full of crimes.
This is the end. Beautiful friend. This is the end. My only friend. The end. Of our elaborate plans. The end. Of everything.
Get out at the metro station Philippe Auguste. There's a bar there called Le Celtique. You follow Rue Pierre Bailloux. It leads to the walls of Père Lachaise Cemetery. There you stop. Turn left into Rue du Ripon. There's a small gate on your right. Go in, avoid the guards if you can, and just follow the way. Stay right. Turn right again into the next street, and these are the streets of Père Lachaise, covered with cobblestones, narrow, hilly terrain, twisting roads and thousands of trees. Left again into the next street, which leads you directly to a grave up the hill. There's a very old, rusty monument in front of you. Follow the narrow path between this one and the one on the left, and after a few feet you'll see a grave on your left. James Douglas Morrison, 1943 to 1971. An inscription in Greek reads, Kata ton daemona etoi. True to his own spirit.
Jim, what do young people worship today? What do they believe? What do they hang on to? What do they hope for?
We want the world and we want it.
We want the world and we want it.
Now. Now.
Père Lachaise, this is where it ends, here where the legend begins.
Hog butcher for the world, toolmaker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders.
Chicago, sweet home Chicago. Ray Manzarek, co-founder of The Doors with Jim Morrison, hails from here. He loved and hated it. Music all around him, California beckoned.
Growing up in Chicago was great. I was in the south side of Chicago, heard all the blues, Muddy Waters and Jimmy Reed and John Lee Hooker, Howlin' Wolf, and then rock and roll happened, and that was all magnificent. Then I graduated from DePaul University in Chicago, 21, and it was time to make a new life for myself, and I certainly wasn't going to stay in that cold place. I was going to the sunshine, where there were girls in bikinis and sports cars and cool jazz, and Jerry Mulligan and Chet Baker and the whole West Coast cool jazz sound. I love that. And poetry and jazz. And it's like, my God, I remember hearing Kenneth Patchen, a poet from San Francisco, playing with on the radio. It was 1959, and it was early December, and it was bleak and drear. Oh, cold weather. Just the beginning of, here we go, into stepping into a winter and going through that hellishness again. And here, I'm listening to the radio, and they play Kenneth Patchen, the poet, reading Lonesome Boy Blues with Modesto Bersenio and the Chamber Jazz Sextet. Modesto Bersenio was like Jerry Mulligan. He played a baritone sax. And it was just the coolest sound. It was out of San Francisco, and I thought, oh, that's what I want. That's where I'm going. And so when it came time, it was off to California.
An anonymous Argentinian tango, probably chosen by director Luis Buñuel for a 1960 revival of the first surrealist film Un Chien Andalou, an Andalusian dog. The University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA's film faculty was fairly new in 1964 and included students Jim Morrison, Ray Manzarek, George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola. Did their viewing actually influence the sound of The Doors?
Oh, sure. Everything. Jim and I both were at the film schools, and actually we both had a class with Joseph von Sternberg, who directed the Marlene Dietrich movies. This is the guy who directed Marlene Dietrich, and Shanghai Express, Blue Angel, etc., etc. We had a class with the Manny, and he was just so intellectual. My God, he was the most intellectual person I'd ever seen. And the dark Germanic sensibility that he brought with him, filled with love and the joy of creativity, and filled with light and excitement, but not afraid to delve into the darker side of humanity. And that's what we tried to do with our music, delve into the darker side of what it meant to be alive on planet Earth, and both the joy of it and the darkness, to be whole human beings. And just the idea of pacing, of cinematic pacing and cinematic intensity from those great master directors, definitely influence, of course. I mean, The Doors music is what it is because of Jim and I going to the UCLA Film School.
Another spring, another love. And yet, it's always the same. Another spring, another love. But love has only one name. Another face, another smile. Another ride back up to the moon.
Another time, see your face in my mind. I can't see your face in my mind. Carnival dogs conceal the lines. Can't see your face in my mind. Don't you cry. Baby, please don't cry. And me with your eyes. I can't seem to find the right light. I can't seem to find the right light. Insanity's horse adorns the sky. Can't seem to find the right line. Consume the lines. Can't see your face in my mind.
Morrison and the Doors are not a thousand miles away from Marlene Dietrich. Jim Morrison hailed from Melbourne, Florida. He was the oldest child of Steve and Clara Morrison, and his father served in the US Navy. In the early years, the Morrison family crisscrossed the country, Florida, Texas, California, New Mexico, and Washington, D.C. Each move brought successive promotions to his father, who eventually retired from the Navy as a Rear Admiral. Jim Morrison was a precocious, solitary boy obsessed with reading. Jack Kerouac led him to the poetry of Allen Ginsberg, and these were two seminal influences. Beyond that matrix was William Burroughs and later Jean Genet, and beyond again to Baudelaire, Rambeau, Nietzsche, Spengler, Blake, and on to arthouse cinema masters like Bergman, Kurosawa, Fellini, Godard and Antonioni. The Beats, led by Kerouac and Ginsberg, and their often apocalyptic vision of contemporary America, made a deep impression on young men like Morrison and Manzarek.
A supermarket in California. What thoughts I have of you tonight, Walt Whitman. For I walk down the side streets under the trees with a headache, self-conscious, looking at the full moon. In my hungry fatigue and shopping for images, I went into the neon fruit supermarket dreaming of your enumerations. What peaches and what penumbras, whole family shopping at night. Aisles full of husbands, wives in the avocados, babies in the tomatoes. And you, Garcia Lorca, what were you doing down by the watermelons? I saw you, Walt Whitman, childless, lonely old grubber, poking among the meats in the refrigerator and eyeing the grocery boys. I heard you asking questions of each. Who killed the pork chops? What priced bananas? Are you my angel? I wandered in and out of the brilliant stacks of cans, following you and followed in my imagination by the store detective. We strode down the open corridors together, in our solitary fancy, tasting artichokes, possessing every frozen delicacy, and never passing the cashier. Where are we going, Walt Whitman? The doors close in an hour. Which way does your beard point tonight? I touch your book and dream of our odyssey in the supermarket and feel absurd. Will we walk all night through solitary streets? The trees add shade to shade, lights out in the houses. We'll both be lonely. Will we stroll dreaming of the lost America of love past blue automobiles and driveways home to our silent cottage? Dear father, gray beard, lonely old courage teacher, what America did you have when Sharon quit poling his ferry and you got out on a smoking bank and stood watching the boat disappear on the black waters of Lethe?
Ginsberg reading A Supermarket in California. In many ways, the Beats were responding to what they read in Oswald Spengler's The Decline of the West. Spengler declared that all historically viable human societies begin as vibrant cultures, eventually rot into stagnant civilizations, and then collapse into chaos in order to be reborn as new, organic cultures which are unified around a prime symbol or central unifying ideal. Cultures experience an almost organic history of spring, summer, autumn and winter. Spengler's original purpose was to provide a relief for a defeated Germany in the wake of World War I. But the Beats read him as an antidote for the spiritual ills of America and as a catalyst in their search for the seeds of the next cycle, for new ways of living in an America returned to the purity of its original myths and ideals. Heady stuff, but America, and nowhere else for that matter, has ever returned to the purity of original myths and ideals. By the time the young Morrison was picking up on all of this, the Beats had entered into American popular culture, and whatever purity they started out with was already warped and distorted. After UCLA, Manzarek played in bands while Morrison led a bohemian lifestyle in nearby Venice Beach, scribbling in notebooks, writing poems and songs, and thanks to a regime of little food and lots of LSD, he slimmed down from a podgy college geek to what the media would soon crown him as, the chiselled Greek god, immortalised in the famed series of black and white photographs taken by Joel Brodsky at around the time of the first album. It was a chance encounter at Venice Beach with Ray Manzarek that led to the formation of The Doors. Morrison sang his own song, Moonlight Drive, to Manzarek. The legend cuts now to a hoarse, dark, threatening voice, the same spirit that inhabits the first two Doors albums in particular. In actual fact, at this stage Morrison's voice was very weak and needed to be doubled to give it body. He sounded more like this. If the lyrical promise was there already, it was the constant gigging around Los Angeles that made the band blossom musically and Morrison grow in confidence as a singer and a very charismatic frontman. Los Angeles itself in the 1960s was a haven for hack songwriters, calculating record companies and motley, unaffiliated hustlers all angling to produce a top 40 hit, all innocence and sin, fantasy and reality. California, the state itself, conjures up fantasy, vast geographical distances, sun, smog and hedonism all conveniently huddled on the Pacific coast. But underneath all the suntan lotion lay a nervous creative energy and a darker heart where the doors were plugged into and what Morrison would soon call the weird scenes inside the gold mine. And for a band that sounded in 1965 like a watery and pale version of the Kinks, they grew quickly into a force to be reckoned with. Check out the sense of menace here in their cover of Willie Dixon's Backdoor Man, where the traditional reading of a backdoor man as a secret lover of a married woman, the one scooting out the back door just as the man of the house is turning his key in the front door, is given a sinister twist by a Morrison who also promises to introduce your nearest and your dearest to something else entirely. The Men Don't Know, But the Little Girls Understand, from The Doors' self-titled debut album, recorded in just a few days in August of 1966 and released in the first week of January in 1967. It featured most of the major songs from their live set at the time, including the 11-minute musical drama The End. Overall, the album deals with individualism, intellectual freedom, in a welter of styles. Rock journalists fell over themselves trying to describe Morrison's poetic and wonderful lyrics, and Morrison turned the interview into a game and gave these writers great quotes to drool over and endlessly spin.
Jim Morrison, singer.
The Doors.
L.A., San Francisco, all up and down the coast. West Coast. West is best.
The Doors. The Unconscious.
The gap is getting wider day by day.
The Doors.
The band you love to hate.
Strange days.
Death.
Rebellion, chaos, disorder, and activity that appears to have no meaning. A central theme or a motif, a thread running through the songs we don't have, but we definitely do have generate an atmosphere or a mood which might be characterized as an awareness of the strange, that something's wrong, something's not quite right.
That literary turn of phrase and Morrison's often outrageous behaviour did the trick with the underground press. He made great copy. Public arrests, on stage and off, fist fights, car crashes, drunken misbehaviour, the human wreckage, dreams, public failure, tainted ledgers, trashed hotel rooms, underage groupies, the harrowing and brutal underbelly of success, and endless anecdotes about all of it. The second single, Light My Fire, was a huge hit in the summer of 1967. It's a casebook Doors performance, with John Coltrane jazz-inspired solos from Manzarek and guitarist Robbie Krieger, pounding, freewheeling drumming from John Densmore, and a smouldering performance from Morrison of what in essence is a very simple song. But very cleverly constructed, though. Were Baroque procedures in the back of Manzarek's mind for this song?
Well, Johann Sebastian Bach, you know, everybody that plays keyboard studies a little bit of Bach. And the Bach in two and three part inventions. Bach number two, and I think it's invention number eight in F. Dun 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 dun. So once you learn how to go ta 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 ta, you can adapt that into rock and roll. So that's what the Light My Fire is. Dun ta 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 ta.
The time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre.
Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
So yeah, sure, you know, everything I did was either, you know, had a classical foundation, a blues foundation, a jazz foundation.
One gets a sense of that from the first album still.
Mm-hmm.
Like you say, it's 40 years, but there's so many different roads and directions on it. There's blues, dark theatre, poetry, melancholy, the sheer rock and roll force of you know, a band going hell for leather.
Mm-hmm.
And soundscaping to a degree.
Yeah.
I mean, how did you decide on such elements? Was it just a unique collection of yous, or did you actually pursue thing? I'm just wondering.
Pure serendipity, pure luck. Boom, there it was. And it was like, how did this happen, man? So everybody brought their own individual expertise into it. Robbie with his flamenco guitar and his bottleneck guitar and jug band folk rock kind of folky sensibilities. John with his jazz drumming, marching drumming. Me with my jazz, blues, and classical stuff, and Jim with his southern gothic, the gothic poetry that he had influenced by the Beats and Rambo and like that. So all those influences all went together to make up The Doors, and they just kept popping out in each song just naturally without having to contrive. None of it was contrived. It was all a very spontaneous and natural time. But then the 60s were like that. They were very spontaneous and very natural. And we were just a reflection of exactly what was going on at the time.
Well, Los Angeles Police Department and California Highway Patrol officers are having a difficult evening. In the general area, we'll still leave out the location. There's no point in emphasizing, pinpointing it, but in the general area of southwest Los Angeles, California Highway Patrol officers encountered a rock barrage from a number of citizens in a housing project. At the present time, some of the citizens are still moving across the street in a rather hostile manner. Some vehicles have been hit. California Highway Patrol car just up along the side.
Strange days have found us. Strange days have tracked us down. They're going to destroy our cash.
From the second Doors album, Strange Days, less spontaneous than their first, but a masterpiece of menace and mood. And one that seems to anticipate what was to come in America in 1968, an America that was on the verge of the greatest possible hopes and the worst despair. 1968 marked the moment when all of America's impulses towards violence, idealism, diversity and disorder peaked. It was a television year. It brought the war in Vietnam and the war in the ghetto into every living room with the power no other medium could match. The pictures Americans saw made millions of them intensely uncomfortable with themselves. Pictures of the South Vietnamese National Police Chief shooting a suspected Viet Cong in the head, of Martin Luther King's casket and of Bobby Kennedy's bleeding body on a hotel kitchen floor. Pictures of the uprisings all over America after King's death, ghetto insurrections, campus revolts. Television fueled the political campaigns of Bobby Kennedy and Richard Nixon while it destroyed Lyndon Johnson. It was an intensely noisy year, and you can still feel it in the very textures of Strange Days. Was the creative use of noise deliberate?
We set out to do musique concrète, and we'll make this madness and chaos and sounds behind Jim's reading, his poetry reading. So, yeah, that was an homage to Stockhausen and Boulez and et cetera, et cetera. So we knew about all that stuff, you know. And that's how it came about.
When the still sea conspires in armor, and her sullen and aborted currents breed tiny monsters, true sailing is dead.
The long, wearying, and oftentimes baffling war against communist rebels in South Vietnam swung sharply toward a new crisis today. For the first time in the years-long struggle, the scene of action has shifted from the jungles and rice paddies to the sea and involved naval craft instead of guerrilla fighters. Hard on the heels of an attack Sunday and in the face of a warning from Washington, North Vietnamese torpedo boats opened an attack on two United States destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin today. The first reports were confused, but it was clear from the beginning that today's attack was much fiercer than that of Sunday. The reports lacked official confirmation until Assistant Defense Secretary Arthur Sylvester issued this statement.
Make a grave for the unknown soldier, nestled in your hollow shoulder. The unknown soldier.
Captain Steve Morrison had participated in that Gulf of Tonkin incident in August 1964, an event which marked the beginning of large-scale US military involvement in Vietnam. And Jim Morrison, his son, the most militant voice in rock music during the 1960s, made his reply in that song, The Unknown Soldier, from The Waiting for the Sun, the third album, and one of the better songs on a very uneven record. Kids' magazines delighted in Morrison's sullen good looks, his dressing in leather. They began to portray the Doors as teen idols for the teeny boppers who turned the albums gold and platinum and made them millionaires. Jimi Hendrix suffered the same fate. What are we to make of all of this? William Burroughs wrote of this time as a brutalising climate of ignorance and conformity. And that's certainly one aspect of contemporary society that Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison, for all their differences, all addressed. Musically, we are in the realm of a poetics of utopia and dystopia, subjects with which all three musicians were consumed. But we're also in mass media, where the same attention and success turned Morrison into the Lizard King, drunk with power and drunk on his own ego. Morrison began experimenting more aggressively with manipulating crowds, while his personal life wheeled out of control and he plunged into alcoholism. The music suffered.
Tell all the people that you see, follow me. Follow me down. Tell all the people that you see, set them free.
Los Angeles, city of light, city of darkness. Los Angeles, the city, often held up as the perfect example of the American dream gone sour, this sprawling urban symbol of everything that is garish, shallow, and self-centered in popular culture. Is that at the heart of the band's fourth studio album, The Soft Parade? It is by far the Doors' most commercial album and the least Doors-sounding album in their catalogue. To its credit, the group was trying to find a new direction for its music, one which would not only allow it to grow, but also would keep Morrison engaged. Morrison insisted that the writing credits be now split accordingly. He also insisted that the orchestrations were taken off his songs on this album. And he was right. This is the Doors' weakest album, and the band sound as if it's searching for an identity. It was about to find one in the most unlikely of places.
I am not allowed to smoke marijuana!
Partial and total nudity on stage, the denunciation of capitalistic greed and of political imperialism, the rejection of war and military service, the enslavement by the state, the living theatre's paradise now blew Jim Morrison away. A few days after this performance by the Living Theatre on March 1st, 1969, the Doors were playing at the Dinner Key Auditorium in Miami, Florida. Morrison arrived very drunk into an overbooked, heaving concert hall, and it was here, in Miami, that Morrison's various demons converged to create a spectacle that would haunt him for the rest of his days. Fired up by the Living Theatre, Morrison goaded the crowd throughout the concert, and at one point directly confronted them with their own adulation for him. Here.
Gonna win, taking over, come on!
It was a chaotic gig. Morrison was out of it, the band was ragged, and then Morrison went to expose himself to the audience. He didn't, but general chaos ensued. The Miami incident outraged local authorities and got Morrison arrested for obscenity. An FBI file was opened on him. Worse, the Doors gigs all over the US were cancelled, ultimately costing the band $1 million. And Morrison was looking at a jail sentence. Ultimately, the Doors were shafted.
Yes, indeed, I agree, of course, yeah, sure. Well, a judge was up for re-election, and they were going to make a statement, and we're going to stop rock and roll, stop the young people. The whole time was the establishment versus the free people. The establishment, the squares, versus the hippies, versus the psychedelic people, versus the as Governor Wallace in Alabama or wherever the hell he was from, communists, revolutionaries, anarchists, and hippies. That was his statement. They were going to stop them. And, of course, the trial was a complete fiasco. But, you know, Jim was definitely obscene. Whether or not he actually did pull it out, as they say, in Miami, we'll never know. I don't think no photos were ever seen. Interestingly, a big stack, about 100 photos, were offered in evidence of everything you could possibly imagine. The riot, the stage collapsing, people going crazy, Jim holding the lamb, wearing a goofy hat that belonged to somebody there with the skull and crossbones looking absolutely demonic in it. There was just general chaos. It was a complete riot in the snake-infested state. They knew the Lizard King was coming, and they were ready for something, and of course they got it. So all kinds of photos, but not one single photo offered an evidence of, as I like to call it, the ivory shaft. Now, did 14,000 people freeze at the moment of exposure when the snake was seen, or did it never happen? You know, or was it one of those things, where, oh, my God, he did it, and no one took a picture? It's odd. No one took a picture? No one's got a picture of Jim Morrison's Willie? So, you know, all I can think is that it never really happened. I never saw it happen. But I did hear him use obscenity, and, you know, but he was convicted. I'm not sure what the charges he was convicted to. So, yeah, it was quite a turning point for the Doors. And
But for the Doors, you did bounce back, and bounce back fantastically with two great studio albums.
Mars, oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, we had a lot of time. We didn't we couldn't tour anymore. We weren't allowed to play America at all. We could play L.A., San Francisco, and in New York we played on TV. We did a TV show in New York. That was about all we were allowed to do. We could not. The Doors were banned from virtually every municipal facility in every major city in America. So we had a lot of time to work on new music, and we went back to the studio and composition at the Doors Workshop, and came up with Morrison Hotel. So everything worked out fine. You know, we have Morrison. I mean, we could have been out there playing, but instead we have Morrison Hotel in our hands, and we can still play. 38 years later, and then L.A. Woman after that.
Scattered on dawn's highway bleeding, ghosts crowd the young child's fragile eggshell mind. Blood in the streets in the town of New Haven. Blood stains the roofs and the palm trees of Venice. Blood in my love in the terrible summer. Bloody red sun of fantastic L.A. Bone in the birth of a nation.
The group's kind of at a critical point right now. It's kind of a crossroads in a way. And but specifically, what I guess we'll be talking about is the new album we have to record in about a couple weeks. So we'll probably be talking about that.
That crossroads had one last masterpiece before Morrison moved on and left the Doors behind him. Blues-based, moody and melodic, an often dark and ominous trip through the sleazier side of life, L.A. Woman was a summer of the band. The leather-clad, swaggering Jim Morrison of 1967 was long gone. In just under 4 years, Morrison had aged a lifetime. The same voice that sang and barked Light My Fire and Backdoor Man was now a hoarse whisper on Riders in the Storm, worn and tired. Still, the gravel in his voice matches the bluesy, jazzy, downbeat music perfectly. And some of Morrison's finest lyrics were also in evidence on L.A. Woman. Nothing too obscure or bizarre to be found, just more honest, godforsaken pain and wonder at Los Angeles, the city of the angels.
Yeah, much louder, much more in the earphones. Yeah, yeah, that's beautiful. But before I begin, I must say that the collective archive is getting me down. You know what I mean. So if there are any desert islands available, please turn me on to them.
L.A. Woman was still high on the charts when, like the actor out on loan of its closing track, Riders on the Storm, Jim Morrison was drifting hopelessly, mysteriously in France in July in 1971. Jim Morrison was anonymous in Paris and often alone, wandering around the Marais, the beautiful ancient Jewish quarter of the city, with its coffee shops, bars and stalls offering fresh vegetables, fish and meat, bread and cheese. He was writing his best poetry, his verse bursting with American landscapes, history, philosophy and literary allusion, but also isolation and depression. As a human, all too human and flawed individual, terribly self-destructive but still looking for answers, Morrison's last days make for painful and confusing reading. Was he beginning a new phase of his life, or was the French capital simply a playground, as it had been for so many exiled American writers before him, escaping censorious indecency laws back home? Is he a fool or a tragic figure or just a drunk with one foot in the grave? He had proceeded to transform himself during his short life through a series of comprehensive rites of passage, delving into literature, music and cinema, experimentation with different kinds of drugs, physical forays into states of isolation and sexual encounters, intense experience. But he was also caught up in the idealistic and pretentious 1960s, and though he tried to use music to transcend the era, ultimately he became defined and clichéd by it, trapped in his own celebrity.
The music was new, black, polished chrome and came over the summer like liquid night. Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stoned, immaculate.
Jim Morrison's corpse was found in the bath of his Rue Beautrellis apartment on the 3rd of July 1971. Cause of death, officially, heart failure induced by years of alcohol and drug abuse. But rumours persisted that he overdosed on heroin in the Rock and Roll Circus nightclub earlier that night and was unceremoniously dumped home in a state of near death. In the end, you are weary of this ancient world, weary of living in Roman antiquity and Greek. Kata ton daemona etoi, true to his own spirit.
Riders on the storm, riders on the storm.